This is KBOO Point Wind.
If I dumb hole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down, and I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Tune in to KBOO Monday mornings at 9 for the Old Mole Variety Hour, your source for radically democratic news, views, reviews, and interviews, stories of ordinary and extraordinary people working to root down the oppressive institutions of capitalism. That's the Old Mole Variety Hour, Monday mornings at 9.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from the Bureau of Labor and Industries Child Care for Construction, working to provide resources and support for new journey workers and their families in partnership with Business Oregon. More info at oregon.gov/BOLI/apprenticeship under the link Financial Assistance for Registered Apprentices.
From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, it's Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. On today's program, we present an encore broadcast of our recent interview with Emmanuel Rosenthal, talking about Colombia and about the new Democratic Socialist Mayor of New York, Zohran Mamdani. Later in the show, we feature an encore broadcast of the story of Eleanor Bumpers and the police killing that galvanized New York City. All this straight ahead on the Best of Flashpoints. Stay tuned.
Flashpoints. I'm Sarah Blanco, sitting in for Dennis Bernstein. We get to hear from Emmanuel Rosenthal, activist with social and indigenous movements in Colombia and the continent for more than 40 years. He is also a physician and a surgeon. Welcome to KPFA and welcome to Flashpoints, Emmanuel Rosenthal.
Thank you very much. Pleasure being here.
We're talking about the context of the war on drugs and the militarization of the Caribbean by the United States and the assassination of what's now 66 people so far accused without evidence or due process, no proof of drug trafficking. The targeting of Venezuela's President Maduro is shocking but definitely believable. I would like for you, as someone who's Colombian, to talk to us about how it's affecting you, Colombians, what Colombians are seeing and feeling.
It sounds like a simple and quick question, but it isn't. In fact, because of the long-standing history of what they call the war on drugs, most people are, I would say, watching what is developing. It seems surreal to most people. The fact that, for example, President Trump not only has accused President Petro of being a drug trafficker and a lunatic and has desertified Colombia, cannot receive funding from the US and cut programs because of Colombia being under a drug trafficker as a president, which is an absolute lie. One could say, one could be in favor or against the policies of President Petro, but for the last 30 years at least, if somebody is the symbol of the struggle against drug trafficking, mafias, drug trade, that has been Gustavo Petro and the people he's associated with. So that's just to give you a feeling for it's not understandable. It's not reasonable. It is beyond reason. So For us, it's very clear that this is a pretext for something else, a lie that is being used to achieve other goals. And then, of course, we know here that we know two things. One is that the Congress people of Florida and Marco Rubio, who comes from there, are the ones leading this whole situation and attacking Petro because they're very closely allied to the mafias and the far right in Colombia, who really are drug traffickers, including former President Álvaro Uribe Vélez. So that's what's going on here. We know the drug traffickers who have held power in Colombia for the last at least 50 years have not been mentioned involved in drug trafficking like Petro has. And now Petro is labeled as a drug trafficker. So that's the feeling here is there's a pretext. But we also know what the pretext is. The pretext is the war on drugs has always been a pretext to address the crisis of that the U.S. is in and the economic crisis globally, and to also benefit from drug trade, both by promoting it and attacking it. The drug trade is being promoted from and by the U.S. because there's a direct transfer of resources and value towards the North. The profit from drug trade goes to the North. And then just to give you an idea, the United Nations produced a recent report in which they showed that a kilogram of cocaine in Colombia is $1,800 here at most. It will be $20,000 on average in the United States, $45,000 to $50,000 in Eastern Europe, Eastern and Western Europe, and up to $90,000 and $200,000 beyond that. So this is business for the North. Money flows towards the North, and the war flows in this direction with hundreds of thousands of people being killed, but not the drug traffickers, not the mafias, not the ones making money from it, but the peasant that grows coca plantations, marijuana plantations, or now the people in boats who may be, because we don't know, are being assassinated, as you said, because maybe they're taking cocaine in small amounts towards the North. So this is not a war on drugs. This is a war for profit. And the war itself provides enormous amount of profit and, as you said before, a pretext to invade or control territories where there is a lot of wealth, such as Venezuelan oil, mining interests, etc. So that's a picture of the way we perceive this here. But it's mostly a shock and trying to understand what are they going to do to us this time.
Now, I had a guest a couple of weeks ago who said that Colombia is one of Trump's true targets. What would you say to that?
Yeah, oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, Colombia has been traditionally a U.S. closest ally in South America for the longest time. What is at stake here, Colombia particularly, is geopolitically, it's the upper corner of South America and against Central America. So the two oceans. Two, the military involvement of the U.S. in Colombia has been total. In fact, the U.S. has controlled the Colombian army. Colombia has been labeled the Israel of Latin America. The coordination between Israeli and U.S. support. And then in every aspect, economic, wealth, legal and illegal trade, not only coca, cocaine, marijuana, but oil, coffee, rare mining, etc. So this is a hugely important place for the U.S. geopolitically has been. So for the first time in our entire history, there's a president of the left, and that president was the first one in the world as a government to break up diplomatic relationships with Israel. to attack the United States and the superpowers for supporting the war and the genocide against the Palestinians. He has also, when the chained Colombians were flown in February by President Trump into Colombia, President Petro refused the flights bringing them back here and would accept them back in Colombia, but without chains and being treated as decent human beings. So the U.S. loses more than Colombia with this relationship and long-standing relationship. But also, there isn't much the U.S. can do successfully in Venezuela without the support of Colombia. If it has failed in Cuba for years and in other places, Venezuela is a huge country. The landscape is enormous with all kinds of possibilities for a long-standing war and resistance. And until the previous governments, the U.S. could count on the Colombian government to support a war in Venezuela. It can't now. And so all these issues play are at stake, and I think you're right in that statement. Colombia is probably a key interest in this whole story.
What do you foresee happening next?
Yeah, well, we see there are two components. Just looking into Venezuela and what is happening there, it's much more complex and it's harder to predict, because of what's going on within the country even before this current U.S. aggression. But I will say this, there was a very good piece recently written on, there's a mechanism that the CIA has used to assess and read what happens, a scenario and the different options that they have. So one such assessment explored the possibilities in terms of the U.S. aggression and the U.S. goal of a regime change in Venezuela. And what this assessment gave us options were three. The first option is all kinds of underground operations, which are probably taking place, supported by this massive military presence in the Caribbean. And what chances of that would have to succeed in a regime change. Historically, these things haven't worked without a military intervention. But in that piece, in that analysis, it seems to be the only feasible or the most feasible action for the U.S. aggression or by the U.S. aggression. The second in scale would be targeted bombings to different places within Venezuela. And that the type of military presence in the Caribbean would allow that. So that is very likely on the map and as a possibility. But whether the U.S. accepts it or not, these kinds of actions have not led to regime changes and have actually led to reinforcement of the mobilization of people against the attack, which would lead to the third option, which would be a full-out military invasion that has almost no chance of succeeding. So in terms of pressure, military pressure, political pressure, what they're doing now, on their own, this wouldn't work. So this is the complexity that I wanted to introduce in the case of Venezuela. It's been a number of years where the Maduro regime, Maduro and Diosdado Cabello and Rodriguez, etc., are in deep trouble within the country. And I'm not talking from the right, which is horrendous. The Venezuelan right, including Maria Corina Machado, the recently laureate for the Nobel Peace Prize. I'm talking about the people on the ground in Venezuela that actually put Chavez into power, that actually were part of the entire Bolivarian movement, and that today for the most part, are the victims of horrendous repression by the Maduro regime. And this is something difficult to say, but very important. Outside of Venezuela, many people think they support the left by supporting Maduro. That is not the case. In fact, President Maduro, through somebody that Trump has sent to Venezuela, has been negotiating to deliver to the U.S. whatever the U.S. wants in exchange for him either remaining in power or leaving power to the vice president of Venezuela and remaining with guarantees within Venezuela. So the regime is repressive. The regime is illegitimate. There was a fraud that led to it winning the previous elections, even though we hate the opposition, and I'm saying it clearly. So this is a factor to keep in mind. The weakness of the Maduro regime is a fact. The thing is that Machado, Maria Corina Machado, and the right in Venezuela is no popular alternative. So there's a trap there. You don't want Maduro anymore because he has actually betrayed what began with Chavez, but you don't want Maria Corina Machado, who encourages a U.S. invasion, who won a Nobel Peace Prize and offered it to Trump, who wants to deliver the country to the U.S. So there's a trap, and we want people to know that. So that plays hugely into these military options and political pressure from the U.S. Marco Rubio wants to topple Maduro. The people of Venezuela do not want a U.S. invasion or pressure. It's all for oil. And the people in Venezuela don't want Maduro nor Maria Corina Machado. And most people in Venezuela are not heard from even by the people who are in solidarity with Venezuela. So there's a huge difficulty there. Many people, you know, had to leave Venezuela because of the economic catastrophe in that country and are everywhere, but mostly in Colombia. There are more Venezuelans in Colombia than in any other country, and close to more in Colombia than there are in Venezuela. And so that situation is complex. It's not black and white. It's not easy to solve. It's not we support Maduro or we support Trump. The question here is, how do we support the people of Venezuela against an empire and against elites and a regime that has lost its legitimacy? So what would we like to see happening, which is very difficult in Venezuela, but we would like to see it happening? And how to get there. The first thing is to know that a government and the state are not the people of a country. You know this in the United States. I mean, Trump was elected. He's probably rejected now by most people, but he is not the people of the U.S. No government is the people of the U.S. No state is the people of a country. The people of Venezuela have to be heard. Without biases, listen to. Spaces have to be open, like this one, to listen to people from social movements, organizations, etc., that are not tied to either the opposition or the government, and who have the credentials of having spent a life defending people's rights, popular movements, the territory, etc. And there are many like that. And those are the ones that are being targeted both by the Maduro regime and the opposition. And that's the difficulty that has to be challenged and the space that has to be opened. But those people are there and can be listened to. The fact that I question Maduro and that I reject that regime does not mean that I support the U.S. or Maria Corina Machado. And that's a big, big question in Venezuela. Now, what should happen? I'll answer this briefly. The U.S. is trying to solve its crisis, and there's a crisis in economic terms, stagnation. They have accumulated capital and they have no place to put it. They have a crisis of legitimacy that actually they are attempting to solve by an opposition to government, which is what Trump stood on. It stood on against the politicians and Washington and so on to actually take over that and develop an even more authoritarian state. But there is a crisis of legitimacy in the North and everywhere else. Three, there is an ecological crisis, a crisis of life is being destroyed everywhere. And finally, because of all of the above, there's a crisis of social, and sorry, of the very possibilities for us to reproduce our life. Most people in all of our countries today cannot make ends meet, and that includes the United States as well. So what should happen, what can happen is, in spite of this and within this context, there have been many processes throughout that are seeking to develop alternatives on the ground, from the ground, collective territories, indigenous peoples, neighborhoods, and there have been massive uprisings in this continent, Chile, Ecuador, Colombia, Peru, in Mexico, and these uprisings have been against the state and beginning to weave agendas beyond the states. And whenever these happen, they have been captured by political electoral processes that are no alternative. So what should happen is we have to make a huge effort, like transforming, for example, no kings beyond protests in the streets to the weaving of people's processes and territories to develop alternatives to this. The states are no solution. The electoral processes are not solutions. And we have to find our way from below. It sounds utopian, but actually the utopian project is try to maintain nation states and what we're going through now. It's a general answer, but it's what's going on.
I'm for utopia. Mm-hmm. I think part of harnessing more, you know, harnessing the momentum of No Kings is the consideration of indigenous people, of black and brown people in terms of the decision making and, you know, being able to have questions, answers, problems and solutions all provided by people of color and indigenous communities is a big portion of that.
Mm-hmm. Huge.
You know, we have a democratic socialist for a New York mayor now. Any comments?
Mm-hmm. It's exciting to see that somebody who's 34 years old, who's Muslim, who comes from below, who did the kind of campaign he did, was able to defeat in their terms, in electoral terms, the establishment. That is amazing. And it is fantastic. And in fact, what it does is, I think it oxygenates, it empowers people to feel one doesn't have to accept what is. That component is extraordinary. And his character, like he speaks Spanish, he speaks his own Arabic, he moves easily within that. But he's getting into the state. He's getting into government, into administering the state. And that is a trap. It has always been a trap. We know it from leftist governments in Latin America. So a government doesn't rule over the state. The state rules over the government, and particularly if it's a leftist government. And the experience in Latin America is clear. In the 1980s, when there was the beginning of the neoliberal state, the far right attacked the state as inefficient, corrupt, non-functional in order to privatize it. It was a trap for the left because the left started then confusing the state with the public sphere. The state has never been the public sphere. It isn't the public sphere. So that now the left was trying to take on power by winning elections. Once within the state, you can either abide by the machinery that they've left in place, which means you have to reproduce and replicate what you don't like and came to change, or you don't abide by that, and so you're not a democrat, you are a dictator. And within that trap, You're controlled and you can't change a thing. And then the disillusion usually leads to the comeback, not only of the right, but of a fascist government, because the left can't do it. So that's the danger. So if the new mayor understands his position, doesn't believe his position as power, but understand that his position is an opportunity to give oxygen to social movements, communities, collectives, and organizations, then he could achieve something beyond himself. But if he wants to follow the rules of the state and believes his position, I'm afraid that it is a trap. And then people will think you can change by electing the right person. And that's not the way to change anything. Certainly, it can help if they understand that.
Any last words in closing?
No, I thank you for the space. I mean, it feels good. Feels at home. I mean what I said about being in touch and remaining in touch to weave, because we can't afford to be alone and not helping each other. I'm really excited and happy about his election, because I think it was an absolutely incredible achievement. And I hope now it's the people that elected him that take over his mandate and not the loneliness of power.
We've been speaking with Emmanuel Rosenthal. I want to thank you very much for joining us at KPFA Berkeley, and for joining us on Flashpoints.
Thank you very much, Sarah. It's really a pleasure to begin this exchange. Thank you.
listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. Joining us now is LaShawn Harris. She's an associate professor of history at Michigan State University, the former managing and book review editor for the Journal of African American History, and a scholar of African American and Black women's histories. Her latest book is Eleanor Bumpers and the Police Killing That Galvanized New York City. Professor Harris, welcome to Flashpoints. It's good to have you with us. And the book is very powerful and very timely. Thanks for writing it.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on the program, Dennis. I'm delighted to be speaking with you.
Well, it's good to have you with us. And again, a very important book. I should say, just as a note, I was teaching at Bronx Regional High School the day after Eleanor Bumpers, some would say murdered, assassinated. One of the things we were actually getting ready to study Hiroshima. We had the director of the Hiroshima National Museum. But one of my students came in, raised his hand, said, "Did you hear about what happened to Eleanor Bumpers? She used to babysit for me." You know, and this is who then the press turned into a dangerous monster who the police were justified in assassinating her. I'm sorry, that's my word. But you were 10 years old when this unfolded. Yeah. You were getting ready to go trick-or-treating, but essentially the world of the Bronx was turned upside down. Tell us about your first knowledge of what happened to Mrs. Bumpers and how that led you to years of study and research and interviews to write this book.
Yes, thank you for that question. Yes, I live across the street from Eleanor Bumpers. From your for your listeners, this is in the Bronx. This is in the Morris Heights community off of University Avenue. I was 10 years old when this happened. Of course, I didn't know her personally. Actually, my parents, we had dogs in our home, and Eleanor Bumpers' daughter, Mary Bumpers, also had dogs. So my parents were friendly with Mary Bumpers, who was Eleanor Bumpers' daughter, who would go on to become an activist. So we knew Mary Bumpers through the community. So when all of this happened on October 29th, 1984, I was, you know, a child getting ready for trick-or-treating, and, you know, we were all preparing for that and couldn't go trick-or-treating in the neighborhood because there were cops and journalists and others kind of surrounding the neighborhood trying to understand what happened, reporters. So I grew up actually seeing this, you know, New York Daily News 1980s photo of Eleanor Bumpers. I grew up hearing her name in, you know, hip-hop songs, and I also grew up seeing her name in film, particularly Spike Lee's She's Gotta Have It and his 1989 film, Do the Right Thing. So what occurred to me after all of those years of just hearing about her, seeing that New York Daily News photo, I really wanted to know who she was as a person before she was killed in her apartment. I was also concerned about how it impacted my Bronx community and the greater New York community. And what did the legal justice organization look like for her? Like, what did that movement look like for, you know, someone who was, you know, a Black woman, disabled, you know, working poor, et cetera. So I was really interested in her interior life, the legal justice campaign, as well as the various groups of grassroots activism that was sparked because of her killing.
Tell us, one of the things, I thought I knew a lot about this case, but I learned a great deal reading your book. And part of it is, you know, the context and the way in which you humanize her and tell us about her story. So she came from the South migrated to New York City during World War II, and she really tried to make a life for herself, for her family, and struggled in the context of extraordinary racism and many challenges. I love how you say cooking was her love language.
I mean, Eleanor Bumpers was, her real name is Elna Gray Williams. And she's, you know, her birthday was on August 22nd, she was born in 1918, from the Jim Crow South, as you said. She's part of a generation of Black women who are migrating during the Second Great Migration of the 1940s. She was a loving mother. She was a protective mother. She was someone who loved to cook, and she loved to dance. She loved flowers. This was someone who also experienced, you know, moments of trauma, isolation, unfulfilled desires. She was a single mother. Her own mother died when she was at least 9 years old. She was arrested several times in the 1940s and 1970s. But this is someone who, despite, as you said, you know, Jim Crow North, despite all of the municipal neglect, this is someone who struggled to take care of her family. And she loved her children fiercely. So her life is both one of, you know, survival, but it's also one of resilience, you know, just in terms of taking care of herself and also taking care of her children.
Let's spend a few minutes on the eviction and the system that evicted her, some would say assassinated her, attempted to degrade her. Her daughter was very brave, one of her daughters, to fight for her reputation and stuff. But talk about it's police violence, consistent, systematic police violence that ultimately cost her her life. She did not have to die.
So prior to October 29th, 1984, when the police actually go into the apartment, it's important for your audience to know that there were two different police officers on the day of the eviction. There was the Housing Authority police, which was not connected to the NYPD. And then there was the NYPD, their emergency service unit. And this is the police that's supposed to be highly skilled. They're trained. These are the cops that are put in charge of dealing with persons with mental health issues. They carry a lot of weaponry on them, shotguns, mace, all types of things. But prior to them actually going into the apartment, Eleanor Bumpers had already faced various forms of municipal neglect. So in July of 1984, she was living in a housing project, but she stopped paying rent. She didn't pay any rent between July 1984 and October 1984. And the Housing Authority sent eviction notices out. It's unclear whether she received those eviction notices. It's unclear if she did, whether she read them or not, because she was dealing with mental health, a mental health condition. And somewhere around that time, we see the Housing Authority social workers actually trying to, or attempting to get Eleanor Bumpers some services. They understand that there's some type of mental health issue, but they don't know exactly what's going on. And what they do is they pass her case off to the Human Resources Administration, which is essentially the city social workers. And in that department, they essentially dropped the ball, because her eviction could have been prevented if the city would have paid the rent. Now, the city had been in the business of paying people's rent in the past, those folks who are economically strapped or people who may have a mental health issue. But for some reason, that did not happen in Eleanor Bumper's case. So before police actually go in, she had already suffered neglect and abandonment from the city. What the Housing Authority does is they put Eleanor in the police's crosshairs. And that's done because they think that she's violent. And, you know, there was these rumors that she, you know, had wielded a knife at folks. And there were other rumors that she was boiling lye. So when the police actually go in, there's this assumption about who she is. They don't see her as a, you know, a grandmother. They don't see her as an elderly person. They don't see her as someone who is, you know, needs help. They see her as someone who is potentially violent. So again, just to kind of stress the point that she was already in danger when she was refused city services between July of 1984 and October of 1984.
And of course, we have to remind people that she also nearly lost her life and her family in a fire that left her, you know, with very little. And there was not a great deal of help in that regard in terms of, you know, getting the help she might need. Let me let people know that we're talking about Tell Her Story, Eleanor Bumpers and the Police Killing That Galvanized New York City. The author is LaShawn Harris, professor at university and has been studying the story for years. You were affected by it as a child, but you followed it through, and it seemed to become a focus of your life for several decades. And it does appear in the context of an emerging movement against state-sponsored violence against black women. You want to talk a little bit about that in the context of the impact of the story and what happened and the way people rose up to support her and her cause?
Sure. Sure. I mean, the campaign for her is really similar, and I say this in the book. I mean, it's probably New York City's first anti-police brutality campaign centered on a black woman. So for the 1980s, the Eleanor Bumpers case appears to be like an early iteration of what Kimberly Crenshaw, legal scholar and the African-American policy forum, will call the hashtag Say Her Name movement in 2014, which is a movement dedicated to bringing visibility to violence against black women and girls. The same thing is happening during the 1980s as it pertains to Eleanor Bumpers. And the case is really a case that is amid a host of other cases of police brutality or white violence against black people. So the cases I'm referring to are Michael Stewart in 1983, Edmund Perry in 1985. These are New York cases. The Michael Griffin case in 1986. This is a case of white violence. Yusuf Hawkins, another case of white violence. And other black women. Sharon Walker was killed 2 months after Eleanor Bumpers in Queens by a black police officer. Yvonne Smallwood was killed. Died in police custody in the late 1980s. So, and those cases received garnered a little bit of attention, but not like the Bumpers case. What's so interesting about the Bumpers case is that it galvanizes New Yorkers in a whole host of ways. So people are, you know, forming organizations such as the Eleanor Bumpers Justice Committee. They are writing letters to, you know, city officials, state officials, you know, children and teenagers, like the ones that you taught at the Bronx Regional High School, are making, you know, a documentary. Children are, you know, writing poems for Eleanor. So there's a community-wide, even beyond the Bronx, where you see people pushing for justice for Eleanor Bumpers. And what they're demanding collectively is that her killer, Stephen Sullivan, be terminated by the NYPD. They're demanding that, you know, Bronx County District Attorney Mario Merola to convene a grand jury, which he eventually does, and charge Sullivan with homicide. They want the welfare workers and the New York City Housing Authority to be held and anyone who had anything to do with the eviction to be held responsible for the eviction. They want a federal probe. And the U.S. attorney at the time was Rudy Giuliani. They want Mayor Koch to immediately release a multi-city agency report on the eviction, which he eventually does. And again, when we think about activists, this is, you know, ordinary working class grassroots people, black men, white men, black women, I mean, people of all racial and ethnic backgrounds coming to you know, say her name and tell her story and to really fight for justice. But this looks like, you know, letter writing campaigns, protests in the streets, talking to media, different types of media, the New York Amsterdam News, the City Sun, you know, just really getting the word out there. And her daughter, Mary Bumpers, I mean, fights for her mother fiercely. I mean, this woman, you know, her mother has just been killed and she's grieving and she's also fighting, you know, the police. The police union, and any other detractors who believe that, you know, her mother was violent and deserved to be killed.
And you really spent, I really admire that you took the time, many interviews over many years with Mary Bumpus, who was taking on the entire police force, because once you disagree with the police force or the official story, you're going to face all kinds of hell, and that includes all kinds of violence. I mean, it's incredible that she was able to keep going, to hold her head high and fight that fight.
Yeah, she said that she told me she's the second oldest. Her sister Fanny Mae Hayes died before seeing Eleanor Bumpers' first daughter. She died before seeing any justice for her mother. And Mary said that her sister said that it's, you have to fight for our mother. You have to be her voice. And again, this is someone who is, you know, she has a high school diploma. Mary Bumpers was out of work. You know, she was unemployed. And this is someone who doesn't have an activist background. So she really had to kind of take a crash course in how to become an activist. But this is someone who, you know, who wanted the city and really the nation, the world, to understand what police violence had done to their family. And they didn't, and she didn't want this to, she didn't want any other family to feel the pain that she, that her family was feeling. And she put that out there, you know, with these political speeches, but it was also bearing her soul about how she had lost, how they had lost their mother.
Yeah, there was, I'm telling you, there was something about that time. I'm remembering that my students, the first thing they did is take our cameras. It was a film history course. Yeah. And they took the cameras right to the keyhole and started filming the next day through the keyhole.
Yeah.
And I can tell you that a couple of my students in that class became very good journalists as a result of seeing this, experiencing this, and being able to fight and do something about it. And that was a gift for people, for young people, to see that they could stand up. There was a fight. Let's spend a few minutes on the murder trial. I'm blanking on the cop's name. Sullivan, was it?
Stephen Sullivan. But let me just say this really quickly.
Yes, please,
about
go
your
on.
Students. Your students, I believe, I would say, are the first journalists, and I'm going to call them journalists because that's the type of work that they were doing.
Wow.
They are the first journalists to really capture the voices of that community. Because as
oh
you
my
said,
God.
They were
you
there
know,
the next day. They are the first journalists to capture. Because if you look at the documentary, I've only seen what I could find online. Like, they interview Mary Bumpers. They're interviewing people who live in the Sedgwick houses. They go to one of the meetings, and they are the ones who are capturing the anger.
I remember one of my students asked one of the people at that community meeting, you know, what do you think about the way they treated Mrs. Bumpers. And the response was from this person who was at this meeting. Did you hear about that animal that escaped from the Bronx Zoo? They shot her with a sleep dart, and they treated the animal better than Mrs. Bumpers. And with rage, this is the kind of stuff set my students on fire. I'm sorry, I interrupted you.
It was goal for me as a scholar, because I'm reading like Jimmy Breslin and other reporters who have great, you know, they're doing great interviews, but the students, you know, those interviews with people who actually lived in the building and on her floor was goal.
It was her babysitter. My student, right. It was his babysitter until she had arthritis and couldn't move around.
That's right. Yes.
Tell us about Stephen Sullivan.
Stephen Sullivan, at that time in 84, was, a veteran cop. I believe he had at least 10 years in the NYPD. This is someone who doesn't live in the city. He lives outside of the city. Dedicated husband, two children, and a former Marine. And on that particular day, when the emergency service unit goes to the Eleanor Bumpers house, Stephen Sullivan does not even have the shotgun. Another police officer had the shotgun. The other police officer's shoe was untied, and Stephen Sullivan says, "Your shoe's untied." And the guy says, "Can you hold the shotgun and let me tie my shoe?" And Stephen Sullivan just ends up having the gun. So it was just by happenstance that he had the shotgun. And they go in and she's shot twice, once in the right hand and the other in the chest. And he's not indicted. He's indicted. There's a grand jury convening in the fall of 1984, little into 1985. And by the end of January of 1985, he is indicted by a Bronx grand jury. That indictment is dismissed by a judge. It goes to the state appellate court. The dismissed indictment is upheld, and by the time it gets to the Court of Appeals in November, maybe the fall of 1986, the court reinstates the indictment. So it's a three-year legal battle to get Stephen Sullivan to trial. He ends up going to trial in January of 1987. And I don't know if I should, I think most people probably know, they probably know what happens, but I'll just leave it there.
People should get the book and read this important book about Eleanor Bumpers, about the nature of police violence, systematic police violence in New York City. And it is was very troubling to me and my students that it was relatively close range, two shots with a shotgun. The first one, as you say, essentially blew her hand off. That wasn't enough. That this arthritic grandmother, they needed a second shot from the shotgun.
The story is that, you know, the blast to the hand, which blew off three fingers, so it would seem like it would be impossible to hold something with three fingers blown off. But the story is three fingers were blown off, and she was still, according to police reports, she was still holding the knife and still flailing. So that was the reason that they gave for the two shots the second shot to the chest. And she doesn't die immediately. Wow. She actually dies when she gets to the hospital. Actually, she's semi-conscious after they shoot her in the chest.
Amazing. Well, this is, as you say, this is a significant case in the focusing in on and resisting, calling attention to the systematic, it is systematic police violence sustained at the highest, in the highest levels of the police community. We're hoping that it will get a little better. I'm concerned given the current atmospheric pressure that we're living under, that these are not going to be good times for the people who are represented in this book and who, these are tough times. But again, let me tell people, tell her story, Eleanor Bumpus, and the police killing that galvanized New York City. A very important book that you've written, and we thank appreciate you. That you took the time out to be with us again. Thank you very much. Really appreciate
your
good work.
Thank you for your activism.
All right. Well, we'll leave it there for now. Be safe. And keep in touch. We want to know what happens with this book. I'm sure we're going to hear more about it. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We'll be back tomorrow.
Does it for another episode of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Senior producers are Miguel Gavilan Molina and Kevin Pina. Technical director is Mike Biggs. Our theme music is written and produced by Charlie Lang. For questions, comments, email Dennis Bernstein at dennis@kpfa.org. Thank you for listening.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Here goes nothing.
Tune in to KBOO for Drinking from Puddles, hosted by Brandon, every other Wednesday from 8 to 10 p.m. Don't say what you want.